Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tuesday morning presented a most shocking scene, the blood of our fellow citizens running like water through King Street. Well, that was an excerpt from the Boston Gazette, Dateline 1770. The story, the Boston Massacre. Now, that sympathetic version of the story, the one most of us are familiar with, British soldiers opening fire on an innocent crowd of colonists, that one was put out with great haste following the massacre, but so was a competing account, one by British officers in a pamphlet titled A Fair Account of the Late Unhappy Disturbance at Boston in New England. According to that view, British soldiers were attacked, quote, by at least 100 people armed with bludgeons, sticks, and cutlasses in a city where it was, quote, unsafe for an officer or soldier to walk the streets. Now, competing narratives put out in the immediate aftermath of an historic event, various sides trying to be the first to win hearts and minds. That battle, of course, continues on today. Eric Hinderacher tells how that information war played out in the story of the Boston Massacre in his new book, Boston's Massacre, and he joins us. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So these competing accounts that I just read out, how quickly after the actual event were they first published?
Well, the Boston Gazette account came out a week after the shootings, and two pamphlets were produced later in the month of March. The one that you just quoted from, The Unhappy Disturbance, the account that was endorsed by the officers and soldiers and customs collectors in Boston. And then the town of Boston prepared its own pamphlet called A Short Account of the Horrid Massacre in Boston, and that also appeared just a couple of weeks after the shootings.
Interesting. Now, I know we're used to instantaneous headlines in this day and age, but back in the 18th century, that seems pretty quick, that just a couple days to a week after this definitive event, we already had competing narratives.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the 18th century press was well enough established that printers swung into action pretty quickly.
Now, I don't think I'm going too far if I say that this sort of immediate desire to define a narrative or to take control of the dominant information is something that we encounter, you know, in the modern era with virtually every police shooting, for example. So why was it important for the pamphleteers and the newspapers in pre-revolutionary Boston to be writing their particular perspectives as quickly as they possibly could?
Well, it's a great question. I think it's a kind of a function of the human mind that we really only can make sense of events by narrating them, by contextualizing them and placing them in a kind of interpretive field. And you see that, you know, in modern politics. We not only disagree fundamentally about events that happen and their significance, but we understand them in relation to larger patterns of understanding that we have. And so the shootings in King Street were very much like that. People wanted immediately to recognize them as part of a larger pattern. And what the pamphleteers and newspaper writers were engaged in was the act of trying to assemble a lot of eyewitness information and then thread that information together in a way that made a coherent and meaningful narrative out of a chaotic and arguably on its own terms sort of meaningless event.
And the narrative had various meanings depending on, you know, who was the audience and what the purpose was. And I want to dive into that more in just a second here. But I suppose I should step back, actually, and just ask you, Professor, you know, we read a couple different accounts here at the top of our conversation. But what parts of the actual story or the actual event of the Boston Massacre were contested at the time? Was the entire thing contested?
Well, we know certain things for sure. You know, we know that a group of soldiers fired into a crowd. We know that five people ultimately died. But if you look at the eyewitness accounts, there are over 200 of them. There are a lot of details that don't agree and that, in fact, fundamentally conflict with each other. And in the most general sense, the Boston Gazette account and the Horrid Massacre account describe a scene in Boston in the hours leading up to the shootings where soldiers were aggressively attacking townspeople in the streets. And the unhappy disturbance describes exactly the opposite. Townspeople gathering in tens and twenties with clubs and cutlasses, armed, creating a disturbance by being belligerent toward the soldiers. So there are certain things that we can agree upon, but I think that it's interesting to really focus on some of the key questions that there is no good basis for establishing agreement on. Historians who've talked about the Boston Massacre in the past have typically constructed a kind of best-guess narrative, you know, deciding which witnesses seemed reliable and kind of putting together a seamless account. So it makes it appear, in retrospect, like there's not that much controversy about what actually happened in Boston on the 5th of March, 1770. My sense is that, in fact, there are pretty big questions that remain unanswered and unanswerable about the tenor of people's behavior in Boston on that day and in that evening.
That's amazing. I mean, because this is one story which just about every American student learns at one time or another. And I think we all learn the same narrative that, you know, here was an act of imperial aggression by those horrible redcoats who shot into a crowd of innocent Bostonians, thereby, you know, providing the trigger for America's desire for freedom and independence. I mean, that's the narrative that we're told when we're in fifth grade.
It is the narrative, and if you look at eyewitness testimony, there are eyewitnesses that claim that there were no more than about two dozen people in King Street in front of the soldiers prior to the shootings, and that they were standing away from them and not doing anything very, very aggressive. Testimony in the trial suggests that there were hundreds of people in the street and that they were armed with clubs and cutlasses and behaving very aggressively. And, you know, I think that, you know, what we end up with in popular memory is a kind of a schizophrenic account of the event. We've all seen the Paul Revere print, which really kind of represents the idea of a small group of townspeople standing away from the soldiers but being fired at anyway.
Well, let me just jump in here if I can for a second, because you mentioned the Paul Revere print. It suddenly occurred to me that there's also a memorial in Boston Common. And on the memorial,
yes,
the Crispus Attucks Memorial, there's a brass relief showing a very similar scene. It's, you know, it's the scene of soldiers shooting into the crowd, and Crispus Attucks is there laying dead on the ground. It's not a scene, of course, you know, according to the account by British officers of people armed with bludgeon sticks and cutlasses. But let's jump ahead here, because this idea of forming a dominant narrative really comes to a head in the trial of the British soldiers, in which John Adams famously served or argued in the defense of those soldiers. And we actually have a little clip here, sadly not of the actual John Adams, but this is Paul Giamatti in the HBO miniseries John Adams that reenacted Adams' defense of the British soldiers. Here it is.
Now the people are crying, kill them, kill them, knock them down. And they're heaving sharp, cutting ice, clubs. What are they to do? Behave like stoic philosophers lost in apathy? Disregard these uniforms. Consider the men who wear them. Consider yourselves in such a situation and judge if a reasonable man would not fear for his life.
That's Paul Giamatti as John Adams in the HBO series.
And really, it's the next best thing, isn't it?
Indeed. So tell us, what was the actual John Adams trying to accomplish here in this trial?
Well, Adams had a very difficult task because he obviously wanted to win the acquittal of the soldiers, but he also wanted to protect the reputation of Boston. You know, the trial had a local context and a transatlantic context, and he was worried about the reputation of Boston in London. And so he adopted a strategy which stressed the violence of rioters on the night of March 5th, but also treated those rioters as outsiders, aliens to the town of Boston. And so the speech that we just heard Paul Giamatti recite is a quote from Adams' closing argument, where he describes a surging mob assaulting the soldiers. But he goes on in that argument to stress that the people who were in the center of that mob were outsiders, outlandish you know, Jack Tars. He talks about racial others. He talks about Negroes and mulattoes. He talks about Irish Teagues and outlandish Jack Tars. And these are phrases that are intended to convey the notion that Boston itself as a corporate community was not to blame, but that outside agitators, I guess we would say, in modern parlance, were really the people who had caused the violence
right.
to occur.
I mean, the modern parlance does jump to mind, outside agitators, anarchists, paid protesters, whatever else they're called these days.
Yes.
So interesting. So Adams was trying to construct a narrative about Boston's purity or goodness, but you also write in the book that it was Adams who chose to highlight Crispus Attucks' role in the massacre.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of the most interesting things about this trial. We have eyewitness testimony from several people that described what was going on immediately in front of the soldiers just before the shootings occurred, that all basically agree with each other. And we also have several eyewitnesses who describe seeing Crispus Attucks just before the shootings, and they describe him as basically a passive bystander. But one witness told a different story. One witness claimed that a stout man burst through the crowd near the soldiers, grabbed one of the bayonets by the musket, clubbed the soldier over the head, and then was shot dead. That testimony came from an African-American youth, a slave named Andrew, who belonged to Oliver Wendell. And when Andrew was asked, you know, who was this stout man, he said, I believe then and I continue to believe that it was the mulatto, meaning Crispus Attucks, the African-American who was one of the five victims of the shootings. And so this was testimony that the lawyers for the town discounted. But Adams found this to be a useful detail, and in narrating, in his own closing argument, narrating the assault on the soldiers, he put Crispus Attucks front and center and basically ends by saying that it's probably due to this man alone that this tragedy occurred in the streets of Boston.
He put the blame on Crispus Attucks?
Yeah, he did. He talked about a large, stout, dark-skinned, stick-wielding man. And, you know, it's a kind of really interesting example of racial scapegoating is really how it reads to a modern eye.
It makes me rethink John Adams a little bit here. That's a so this is one of the many eye-opening things about what you raise in your book. The truth about Adams is sort of multifaceted goals with defending the British soldiers during the trial. The fact that there's still a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what happened. And that, you know, as you write, the trials were as much a struggle to construct a dominant consensus narrative as they were an attempt to attain justice for the accused. So that just gets me to wondering, you know, I feel like we still go through this in the modern era. Every time there's a high-profile political or controversial event. I mentioned police shootings earlier, but there are other moments in American history. You write about the shootings at Kent State or, more currently, the Black Lives Matter movement. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about watching the interpretation of the Boston Massacre unfold is the way that, you know, what was initially a hotly contested interpretive problem turns into a kind of consensus narrative. It starts happening right after the trials. Bostonians were initially furious that nobody was convicted of murder in the trials. But they pretty quickly realized that that didn't really matter to them and that they could commemorate the event the way they wanted and they could remember the event the way they wanted anyway. And they went on to do that. And so there's this tradition of the Boston Massacre oration. There is the very prominent Paul Revere print and other spurs to memory, you know, that were generated at the time. And I think one effect of that was to diminish people's awareness that there were kind of two sides to the Boston Massacre story. And so in Kent State, when National Guardsmen fired into a crowd of students in Kent, Ohio, outraged students and other outraged Americans immediately thought of the Boston Massacre. You know, this is just like the Boston Massacre. You know, you've got soldiers firing into an innocent crowd of civilians. And that analogy immediately appeared in the press. Well, so did pushback, because just as quickly in the press, people could argue, yeah, it is like the Boston Massacre. And in the Boston Massacre, a lawless mob attacked soldiers who were only doing their duty. You know, so it's really interesting how the sort of controversy about what actually happened is kind of largely forgotten, you know, in the long period when the Boston Massacre had not been contested. But as soon as an event came along that kind of re-energized its power as an analogy, the analogy also splits apart, right? So it provides as much fuel for critics of the students who are being fired at as it does for critics of the National Guardsmen. And in fact, in the immediate wake of those shootings, public opinion in the United States was much more favorable to the National Guardsmen than to the students, interestingly enough.
And I feel like we see something virtually identical with Black Lives Matter.
Well, Black Lives Matter is similar. And Black Lives Matter is a very complicated, it's hard to extend the analogy because there's not a single event that we can sort of parse and take apart. But to take just the example of Michael Brown in Ferguson, you know, there is ongoing controversy over the question of exactly what he was doing in the hours leading up to the shooting and so on. And clearly, there is both an argument that says that African Americans are disproportionately the victims of violent force vis-a-vis law enforcement agents, and there is also the argument that says that the police are in difficult circumstances all over the country doing their best, and that the Black Lives Matter movement is not helping. It is actually, you know, interfering with the process of maintaining public order. So again, that pattern of contestation is clear.
I feel like the lesson from your book and from this conversation is that for hundreds of years, but especially now, we need to maintain skepticism of any narrative from any event that seeks to be the dominant one.
Well, I think that's true. You know, I think it's interesting. One of the things that as a historian of early America that I see over and over again is that people are always wanting to, when they regard our own times and our own circumstances as chaotic, people often look to the past for a sense of relative clarity. And people think of, especially of the founding era, as a time when basically everybody agreed and everybody got along. And we kind of long for this consensus period when the truth wasn't so elusive. But, you know, that is really a kind of a fiction, that sense that the past, that the revolutionary era was an era of consensus, is really misplaced. And consensus is something that can only be generated through the hard labor of, you know, people that are making political arguments and trying to get them to stick. You know, some degree of consensus is a good thing, but these consensus positions always have to be tested against what we know, what we believe, and, you know, what the other side is saying.
Well, Eric Hinderacher is professor of history at the University of Utah. His new book is Boston's Massacre. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.